Will President Bush wear a hat to his inauguration? Probably not. Maybe a Rangers baseball cap. American men just do not wear hats the way they used to, when headgear was considered as necessary as shoes. Hatless has become proper on formal and social occasions. Now, the popular assumption is that American men stopped wearing hats after John F. Kennedy didn't wear one to his inaugural in 1961. Actually, he did wear a hat. He just took it off and on during the day. Neil Steinberg joins us now to sort through hat facts and fiction. Mr. Steinberg is a columnist at the Chicago Sun-Times and the author of a new book, Hatless Jack, The President, the Fedora, and the History of an American Style. He joins us from Chicago. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Scott.
Now, there was a lot of consternation as to whether or not Senator Kennedy would or would not wear a hat at his inauguration as president.
This was an enormous deal. Kennedy was really Labor's boy. They had backed him early, the Hatters specifically. And I mean, he met the day before he was sworn in. He met with Harry Truman. He met with President Eisenhower. He met with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he met with Alex Rose, the president of the United Hatters Cap and Millinery Workers International, who gave him a hat. I think people expected him to not wear a hat. That was his reputation. He was famous for being hatless. And no matter how many times he wore one, and he wore one a good amount of times, it never got rid of it. Just in the same way he wore glasses. But people don't think of him as wearing glasses.
So hat sales had really been in decline since the 1930s.
Hat sales in 1960 were half of what they were in the 50s, in 1950. What happened was basically this. Youth became good. Conformity became bad. That's such a great assumption. I mean, it's such a given now that we forget that that wasn't always the case. We see these pictures from the 20s of all the men in the straw boaters, you know, at a baseball game, and we think, oh, how nice, what a sense of style they had. No, they wore those hats because they had to. And if you didn't wear a hat, you were drunk, or you had been beaten up, or you were an errand boy. I mean, there was something wrong with you.
Well, now, there were a lot of just social and even practical forces that were working against the hat, weren't there? I mean, cars, for example, people didn't need protection from the weather they used to.
Right. You didn't need protection against the weather. It was hard to wear after the late 40s when they started to streamline the cars. It was hard to wear a hat while you drove. But primarily, cars helped kill off hats by their social function. You weren't passing people in the street. And so they weren't noticing whether you had a hat or not. You didn't need the hat to greet the ladies and all that sort of stuff.
Didn't hats create a storage problem, too?
Enormous storage problem. And that's another reason they died out. Men got tired of checking their hats. They got tired of having to pay a dime to hat check girls. I go through the whole history of the hat check business for the first 50 years of the 20th century. It was this sort of part of the set piece of nightclubbing, and a hat check girl was this half-alluring, half-friendly figure, kind of halfway between a sister and a low woman.
Mr. Steinberg?
Yes.
As I believe the folks there in Chicago know, my mother was a hat check girl at the Shea Paree.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, no, she
I'm sure she was the sister kind of hat check girl. But it was an awful, I mean, it was an awful job. I'm sure she told you that, you know, that all these Cinderella stories, and there were movies about hat check girls and novels and radio shows and that kind of thing. Yet it really was an awful job. And the scandal that came out with increasing frequency as the years went by was they didn't get to keep their tips. Yeah. And so men would kind of give a wink. It was a mild form of flirtation. You'd give your quarter over to the hat check girl, and she, of course, would give it to the people who ran the hat check, which were these enormously lucrative businesses.
Mm. I was reminded again, reading your book, of the story, the way in which haberdashery terms worked their way into our language, and there were common assumptions.
I don't even try to list them all. You know, throwing your hat in the ring and hats off and just talking through your hat and eating out of your hat and all that sort of stuff. It's odd that they're still all with us. You know exactly what they mean. Throw your hat in the ring is a particularly meaningful one for me because what did that mean? It was a boxing term. Teddy Roosevelt first popularized it when he was announcing his candidacy. And you threw your hat in the ring, it meant you were committing yourself. Why? Because it was your hat, and you had to go where that hat was. Hats were expensive, and a hat was also sort of considered this kind of quasi-personality, like a mini-you. You had molded it to your head, you had picked it out, you had it on your brow sometimes for years, and hats were considered these like mini-people. That's one of the oddest things in the book. In the 1920s, when round-the-world flight became possible and newspapers started sending reporters on the Graf Zeppelin and China Clipper and things around the world, people became intrigued with such travel, and people in the hinterlands couldn't do it, obviously. It was very expensive. So they would give their hats. A baggage handler in St. Louis would give his hat to a sympathetic pilot who would take it to Los Angeles, who would hand it off to another pilot. And these hats would circumnavigate the globe, sometimes for years. They would get names, Hobo the Hat and this and that. And then they would come back home, and they would have these touching civic ceremonies where the hat was welcomed sort of as this world traveler. It was very strange. That's why every once in a while people say hats are back, and I always kind of laugh, because hats are never coming back. Not in the sense that you know, your father would take you down to Marshall Fields and he would select this expensive fedora, and you know, it used to be a man who needed a half dozen hats, if not a dozen hats.
Abraham Lincoln had, arguably, perhaps the most famous top hat in American history. Mm-hmm. Someone had to hold it while he was sworn in at his inauguration, and I didn't know until reading your book who that was.
Like any other man, you had to figure out what to do with your hat, and as Lincoln approaches to give this famous first inaugural, he takes his hat off, and he doesn't know what to do with it. And there's sort of a scuffle between a Kentucky journalist and Stephen Douglas, because holding a great man's hat was sort of an honor. It was a kind of humility, because the butler held the hat, really. It was a servile thing to do, but when someone is the president, when you're a great man, you want to be servile. And so Douglas won the scuffle, and he held the hat, and he said very famously, "I may not be able to be president, but I can hold the president's hat."
I want you to wind up, Mr. Steinberg, by telling us a good hat story involving President Kennedy on his father on that inauguration day in 1961.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, tipping your hat was an enormously important bit of symbolism. And after the inauguration, when he returned to the White House where the reviewing stand had been set up, Joe Kennedy was waiting there. Some people saw Kennedy rise and tip his hat to his father, and his father returned the gesture. Other people saw Joseph Kennedy, this elder, you know, taskmaster who had driven his son to the presidency, rise first and give this tribute to his son that his daughter said he had never done before. And so it was this very, to everyone who saw it, they interpreted it differently, but they all agreed it was this moving moment of sort of a passing of the helm from the power broker of Joe Kennedy to the true power of his son, John F. Kennedy.
All symbolized by the tipping of a couple of hats.
It wasn't to keep out the cold and the wind. A hat was a symbolic thing, and I think that's what we miss most. We don't really need it for the weather. It would be nice, but we really could use it, I think, on some days for the symbolism and the useful things that a hat could do, because people tend to not see it, just as they didn't see the hat on Kennedy's head.
Neil Steinberg is the author of Hatless Jack, The President, The Fedora, and The History of American Style. Tip of our hat to you, Mr. Steinberg. Thank you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.